will work for the Washington County Historical Society, beginning an interview with Rand Fisher on August 29th, 1996. And today's interview is taking place in his office at the Soil and Water
Washington County Soil and Water Conservation District.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe I'd start off just by asking you where you were born and when.
Well, for whatever it's worth, I was born in Ewa, Hawaii in 1947.
Okay. And did you grow up in Hawaii then?
For 6 months. And my father's in the military, who moved around a lot, so I was all over while I was growing up.
Uh-huh. When did you first come to this area then?
Moved to Washington County in 1971. After I graduated from college, I got a job here as a school teacher, and mm-hmm. So came in 71, and I've lived here in Washington County ever since.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said you spent your first 6 months in Hawaii. Where did you go next?
Oh, well, you know, just the history of military moves. Went to family moved to Seattle, and then Spokane, then Kaysville, Utah, then we went to Cedar City, Utah, when my dad was in Korea. Then we moved to Alabama, then to Ohio, then Boulder, Colorado, then San Bernardino, California, then back to Kaysville, Utah, where he retired.
Uh-huh. Okay. Sounds like you've been around a few places while you were growing up, anyway.
Yeah. And then while I was there, while I was in college, I got a job working for the Forest Service on a fire crew out in eastern Oregon for a couple of summers. Mm-hmm. And decided I really liked Oregon, so looked to come here.
Mm-hmm. And where did you go to college?
Utah State University.
Okay.
In geology was my major. Geology, had double major in geology and in education.
Mm-hmm. What did your father do in the Navy?
Air Force. Well, during the war, he was a pilot, and then I, you know, when a kid, you don't know exactly what he's doing. You just know where he works. But he was in officer training quite a bit. The new recruits coming in, he'd be involved in training them. Then he was also relations between the Air Force and Thiokol Chemical Corporation in their production of their missiles, and so he worked in that for quite a while. Also, some of the major things that he did.
Mm-hmm. So he involved with Thiokol when the Challenger accident.
No,
occurred?
He had retired from that long before then.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your mother, was she a housewife during most of this time? Or?
Most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You decided not to pursue a military career, it sounds like. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
What were some of your early interests
I was always interested in the outdoors and nature and like people, some too, but I always enjoyed getting out in the fresh air and enjoying mountains especially, but all those different kind of things. And so as I said, one of the early jobs I got into was in the Forest Service, and like that. And while I was going to school, well, like a lot of people, you start off just taking general ed because you don't really know what you're there for, you just know you're supposed to be in college. So I kept taking things, and when I took science classes, I kind of liked that, and I especially got interested in geology, and so I pursued that as a major. And also liked sharing information with people, so took education as a major also.
Mm. Oh, so you had a dual
mm-hmm,
major.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then when I had those, I looked what to do with it. Well, I know science, I know teaching, so maybe be a science teacher. What I got into.
Is that what your first mm-hmm. Job out of college was?
Mm-hmm.
And where was that?
That was in Beaverton.
In Beaverton?
Beaverton schools.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and that would have been 71 when you
right.
came here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how long were you with the Beaverton Schools
there? Oh, over 20 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. You decided to retire from teaching after that period, or?
Yeah, well, during the summers, I also got a job during the summer with the National Park Service. I enjoyed that, so I got to worked at Glen Canyon National Recreation Area and up on Lake Roosevelt, Cooley Dam for a summer, and Tippinogis Cave as a guide there with the Park Service. So I had four summers in that that I liked. And then while I was teaching, Bonneville Power had a program to where they would hire teachers during the summer. And the idea was that they'd get some sort of miscellaneous work done they needed with some people who were skilled and trained because they're, you know, educated. But at the same time, it would also orient the teacher to some of the concerns that Bonneville Power had for energy conservation and fish habitat improvement and protection enhancement. So it was sort of a dual benefit that Bonneville Power gets some work done they need it, but at the same time I get some training that Bonneville wants me to know about so I can share it with the students that I teach. And I worked that at two summers, and after 20 years of teaching, I thought I liked that, just preferred that to going back to teaching after you've been doing it for a long time. And kids are wonderful, but some of us just aren't to where we can feel like spending a whole lot more time with 180 13-year-olds every day is maybe a little more challenge than we're up to. So when Bonneville Power looked like they had a job opening, I asked if I could get in there, and they said yes, and so I went to that with the Fish and Wildlife Division in Bonneville Power.
Uh-huh. And what? When was that that you made that move?
That was in 92.
92, okay. Mm-hmm. And before that you'd worked the summers at Bonneville in energy conservation primarily, or?
No, in the Fish and Wildlife Division in their fish habitat enhancement as environmental education coordinator was
okay.
My position there.
For the summer positions.
Yes.
I see.
And then it continued in it full time after that for a while. Mm-hmm. Until they had their cutbacks and what I was told originally that we'll put you on temporary now and we'll be able to get you full time in a year. And in a year the money ran out and Bonneville was cutting back, so I was the last hired, first fired mm-hmm. situation.
So you worked for them for just about a year then?
A little over a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Earlier, your work at the national parks, was that when you were still a student, or?
No, it's while I was a teacher.
It was also while you were a teacher. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And what I did most of the summers is I have a small farm north of Hillsboro and work on that, raise cattle and just a few of them, and some fruit trees and berry bushes and that sort of thing. Just have a small acreage out there and raise a few things out in the country.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a family then?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They help you out a little bit on the farm?
Oh, or? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And did you get the farm about the same time that you moved to this area, or was it?
No, it was, I'd been here. I got the farm and I think we bought it in 78 and were able to build and move to it in 80. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I've lived in the same place now for 16 years. Mm-hmm.
When you first came to the area, it sounds like you've spent some time out in nature. Did you involve yourself at all with the sort of semi-urban natural areas are out here in the valley, or were you primarily focused on pristine nature that was a little further out of town?
Well, I don't know if I've been really all that much into nature. I mean, a lot of people who, you know, enjoy looking at nice scenery with trees and maybe birds flying overhead, and you know, I'm not one who, I don't know if you'd call it an activist, I'm not that. I just kind of enjoy the peaceful, somewhat rural settings. And I think a lot of people do prefer that to, at least for a steady diet, prefer that to the noise and compactness of right in the city. At least if they like it in the city, a lot of people who live in the city and like it also like to get out in the country for once in a while, just to get a little change of pace and take a big breath and kind of let go of the tensions for a moment. And that's kind of where I am. Just I like to do it a little more often than others, I guess.
Yeah, well, I do too, actually. I like to take advantage of every opportunity I get, even though I live in the city. I mean, really in the city, not like you. I'm maybe more specifically, I'm just wondering when you might have begun to have an awareness of the Tualatin or the watershed out here.
To be honest on that, it's just something that sort of slowly accumulates. And to be honest, it wasn't that I woke up one morning thinking the Tualatin watershed, that's my everything flows downstream, and I get all the bits and pieces together as I teach science. And part of what I teach in earth science is water cycle and water movement and soils, and that's part of what I taught. And just as you teach things, you learn things, and you just sort of get little bits and pieces of information that sort of slowly, as they start to fit together, you sort of get to see that, hey, these aren't all disjointed. There's sort of a picture here about how things go and how little things that we might do that we sort of think are maybe not great, but they're not hurting anything. When you accumulate them all together, you find that there are some problems caused by being careless, and I and everybody else needs to be responsible for the little things. And primarily the big problems are caused by, at least for the most part, and that's kind of what non-point source pollution is by people just not worrying about little details. It's just kind of hoping the well that's not too big and it's not too important, so it doesn't matter, so it won't do anything. And unfortunately, when you have 10 or 20 or 100,000 people not worrying about the little things become big things. And so I and everyone needs to just be aware of those little things and take just a few more minutes or a little bit more time or another dollar or something to kind of keep things so that we end up with something that's useful and valuable and viable here in the Tualatin watershed, all working on that to help to keep it from destroying something that's really a wonderful resource that, like I was just talking about, is something that most of us like to get out and enjoy, and so that it doesn't become more of a headache and worry and concern and something we want to avoid. We want to make it something that's desirable to go to rather than something we want to get away from.
And in terms of your own personal interaction with the Tualatin or other parts of the watershed, have you taken advantage of the recreational opportunities that are there?
Not much, and a large part of that is because there aren't a lot of really easily readily accessible recreational opportunities on the Tualatin. It's pretty much private landowners, and if you want to get to Tualatin, you have to kind of sneak down by the bridge to get to it, and you have to have a canoe or a boat of some kind to get down and enjoy the river. Now that's changing because the Metro Green Spaces just made a big purchase, so there's going to be a lot better access, and I think a lot more people will be able to get down and use and enjoy the river. I think they've just purchased one section, I think it's 120 acres down near Shoals, and they're considering purchasing some other streamside properties, which I think will make it much more available for a lot of people. But I had not gotten down to enjoy the river because it's private property and I can't be hopping over somebody's fence to go down and do something I want to do, so I just hadn't really done much, and more than just once in a while up at Gaston I'd stop and look at the bridge. And I'd a few years back I got into class and was able to go up through the lock gates because we were with a group where they had permission to go up to see Lee Falls and some of the upper Tualatin up there, which is totally different from the lower river, if you've been up there to see it.
I haven't.
It's night and day. You know, down here you have the lower river, which we all think of the Tualatin as that warm kind of brown, slow-moving thing that almost seems like it's something out of Alabama, only not quite the same. You get up above Gaston, and there's waterfalls, clear water, fish jumping, and cold water, and just it's a mountain wonderland up there. It's just wonderful and beautiful, and love it, and just see that there's it's a totally different river up there than the one we're familiar with. And you know, I was able to see that several years ago, and loved it. I just wish that there was more access for that, because that's on, again, private property and people can't go up to see it. But I understand the reason for that. There used to be a public access. I mean, when I went up, it had been many years, but you could see where people had just left their garbage and litter and filth. It was where people had had public access. People had just destroyed it and, you know, blazed trees or cut things down and dumped garbage. And the timber company that owns property just hadn't bothered to clean it up. They just decided, we don't want any more of this, so we'll just block it off. So they made it so there wasn't access to people, and that's a shame, because it's up there by Lee Falls. It's really close to Forest Grove. It'd be easy access, and to me, it beats the state parks, like at Lewis and Clark Park or several other state parks we have. I mean, that's high quality mountain recreation, beautiful place to be up there. And it's just a shame that you have some elements. You know, it only takes a small percentage of people who are going to be careless and destroy something to mess it up for everybody, and that's what happened up there, because the timber companies used to let people go up and use it.
Uh-huh. But they now have it access restricted,
right
there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the communities of Forest Grove and Hillsborough at least rely on that upper watershed for their water
supply,
too. That's
right, they do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, this Lee Falls is below where they get their water from, but, you know, they just, farther up, if they let people get up in there a whole lot, why, again, they'd have the problems with their water supply. Though, as you know, a significant part of the water supply is pumped down here from the Spring Hill pump station, and that's down below Gaston, and almost Forest Grove is where they pump the water out, and that provides water for the Tualatin Valley Irrigation District, and also a lot of the water goes up and is to tanks and is treated for Forest Grove, and I believe some of the Hillsborough water comes from there also, our drinking water.
Uh-huh. But and it's mixed in then with water from higher up.
Yeah, they mix those two together, and that's the water that from the Tualatin and from Hag Lake are the main sources of the water that comes in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you arrived on the scene, it sounds like, just about the time that the 20-some-year effort to get a water project built up there finally succeeded, namely the Hag Lake Reservoir.
Mm-hmm.
Were you at all aware of that at the time that it first opened up, when they first started, when they had the, you know, opening ceremony and actually got the started accumulating water behind the dam for the first time?
I wasn't part of that ceremony. Didn't participate in that. I mean, I was there when the dam was being built. In fact, at that time, I was before the dam was built. You know, they went and they had to move everybody out, and they cut down a lot of trees. And I was with working on some funding for a youth group, and we got permission to get firewood. So we went up and got firewood where they're cutting it down, where the reservoir was going to fill up. We were able to get that and haul it out and sell it to raise some money for the youth group projects we had on there. And in the process, I got my pickup truck stuck in the very bottom of Hag Lake. What's Hag Lake now? Because we were going through a creek to go over and get the wood, and my pickup truck got stuck in the mud down the bottom of the creek, Wiscoggins Creek.
Uh-huh.
And there wasn't a bridge, you just got stuck in the creek. But so I had to get somebody quite a work job to get the truck pulled out of there with its load of wood on it, but we got it out. So it's not at the bottom of the lake now.
That must have been interesting to be in there when they were actually clearing it for the reservoir then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's some pretty country up there, and you know, we've got a real nice lake, but it was really beautiful land up there before too.
Right, I guess that's the trade-off for mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm.
And I was here after the lake started to fill up, and it's interesting. I had to go down to take some summer classes down at University of California at Berkeley, and I was doing a paper down there on, it was really an education class, environmental science class. What we're doing, I had to pick a project, so I took as a project studying the Hag Lake and what the possible effects might be of that, you know, beneficial and harmful effects that might come from it. And you know, I wasn't really familiar with the area, but just from the research that I did and the literature that was down at University of California, Berkeley, looked at the geology and studied the maps, and it looked to me like the problem would be that there'd be a whole lot of landslides, because that land would be extremely sensitive to landslides if it got filled with water. And just kind of funny that I wrote that on my paper that I turned in there. That was in 73, before they had any water in the dam. And it was just a couple of years later, you know, they put the road around the lake, and within 2 years the road had fallen in a whole bunch of places, and they'd had landslides on one side, and landslides, the whole area they developed for picnics and everything, had slid into the lake, and roads had slid into the lake, and everything was falling down right and left all around the lake. And they've got that to where I think the sliding has stopped to be able to stabilize that. But I'm just surprised that they hadn't looked at that before, because I don't consider myself an expert structural geologist, but just from what's very evident in the geology manuals of studies of this area, you look at the rocks and it says it's going to be landslides if you put water in there, if you don't get it graded off to the right slope to begin with. But they apparently, somebody didn't read their geology books before they made the dam. So
so that would have been the solution then, to grade it more gradually, so the slope would be more gradual mm-hmm. into the lake.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And instead, that's just happened kind of as a natural phenomenon.
Well, when they've had landslides go into the lake, then that does some grading naturally, because it's pulling it down, and they go in with their bulldozers and the scrapers and have made it a more gentle slope, so it doesn't happen again. And that seems to have pretty well stopped the sliding several years ago now.
Mm-hmm. What other conclusions did you come to in your paper about advantages and disadvantages?
Well, mine was just primarily about the geology aspects of it, you know, there'd be some benefits to water quality, in that you'd have sediment coming out, and that you'd have a more steady supply of water going into the river, which had a tendency to warm up, and we've certainly had those beneficial results from it. Of course, the downside is that if there's any anadromous fish, they can't go past the dam, so there's none, you know, up in Scoggins Creek now. That was, you know, the primary drawbacks to it, and along with, you know, you destroy the lowland habitat, the land that was there before where there were deer and owl and farms and other things, that's all underwater now, so now you have water skiing where you used to have farming and wildlife. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, there's good and bad in both of that, and there's a whole lot more people using it, enjoying it now than there were before, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So overall, looking back on it now, do you think that it was a net positive though?
I think benefits to the area. To the Tualatin Basin and the people in it, benefits far outweigh any disadvantages to it there. You know, it's not natural, and so if you're going to be pure, I'm 100% natural person, well, they wouldn't like it, but I think there's a lot of real positive benefits to Scoggins Dam and Hag Lake there. And again, there's drawbacks to all of them, just the kind of things that I told you about. You stop fish runs and you cover up some valuable farmland and wood growing land and wildlife habitat, and you sort of disrupt the natural system. But I would personally see some benefits to putting in another dam or two in the valley.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, there are other projects on the drawing boards, so to speak.
They proposed some. Most of them have been shut down, but they've proposed putting a dam in Patton Valley, I believe, and another one up on Rock Creek several years ago, but then they crossed those off. And I'm not familiar with all the details of how they reached those decisions.
The Patton Valley one, that would be the one that was on the main stem of the Tualatin,
right? Mm-hmm.
Right. Just over the ridge from Hag Lake?
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. And I guess part of the problem there is that it would not only flood out trees and farmland, but part of Cherry Grove also.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So some people, I think, feel that it's time for that project to be built now. Mm-hmm. Hag Lake, of course, did do a great deal for, you know, water supply and to augment the flow of the Tualatin.
It did considerable good for flood control too.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have the figures, I think it's 14 or 16% of the watershed is from Scoggins Creek. So when we have floods like last February, when people, I don't know, do you know Wally Otto of the dam? Have you talked with him?
No, I haven't yet.
He's the operates the dam up there. And when he was doing that first on the dam, you know, when you've got a reservoir, he wants to control the floods as much as he can. But his first safety concern has to be that he has to keep the dam from blowing out. You know, he can't let the water build up so much that it's going to wash out the dam. So he has certain limits, standard limits, that when the water gets to this level, he has to let it go. He can't hold it anymore. And he got, he was holding back as much as he could. When it got up to the level where it was prime level, he had to open the floodgates and let the water level out as slow as he could, but he had to keep it so it didn't go higher, so the dam didn't blow out. He got all kinds of swearing and threatening phone calls. Somebody called up, I understand, and said they were going to blow up his house or shoot his wife if he didn't shut off the water because they were causing problems in the flooding. And, you know, what's he supposed to do? It's just awful that people so misinformed that they're doing that kind of thing when somebody's making tremendous efforts to try and control it as much as possible on there. But, mm-hmm. People, when they've got a foot of water in their house, they get pretty upset and just want to figure there must be somebody to blame, and it must be that guy up there operating the dam. So,
right. Well, I guess the floods of '96 were extraordinary enough to really challenge the whole system.
Yeah. And if we had more dams, of course, there'd be a lot more control. Rather than controlling 16% of the watershed, you'd control a significant more, and so you'd be able to reduce damage from floods considerably, I would expect, if we had more dams in either Patton Valley or Rock Creek or Gales Creek, or wherever they might put one in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, I guess with the population explosion out here associated with a lot of the high-tech industry moving in, et cetera, and just, you know, general urban growth from Portland, you have more need for water too.
Oh yeah.
I guess when the Scoggins project was originally built, there was all this extra water, and even that got snapped up fairly quickly.
Yeah. So there is now and will be significantly more need for more water in the future. Somebody from the state, it was at a meeting, I wish I could remember who it was. It was sometime last winter anyway. They were saying that there's consideration for water because there's a lot of people who are against putting more dams here, and you're not certain how much water you're going to get from that. Saying that would take more water from the Willamette River, and that a likely proposal would be to take some water out somewhere near either Newburgh, I guess Wilsonville, really is where they were thinking of taking water and putting in a 6-foot pipe and pumping that up to the Tualatin Valley to use for drinking water up here.
Hold on for just
And sounds like a reasonable idea. You know, some people think, well, the Willamette River, that's not, that just wouldn't want to touch that water. But you think about people in the Mississippi and all the water in New Orleans' drinking water system is, it's been through about, I want to say the average drop of water if you get out of your tap in New Orleans has been through at least 17 sewage treatment plants before it gets to your tap. And who knows how many industrial plants along the way. So it'd certainly be cleaner than that. But then just hearing some reports on the news a couple of weeks ago where some group, I'm not sure who, some environmental group is catching and studying fish on the lower Willamette between Newburgh and Oregon City. And they're finding that, 85% of the fish have deformities on them, that there's something wrong with their fins and they're not growing properly and they don't know what it is. They think it might be chemicals or something, but if the fish are having deformities and birth defects and growth problems, I'd want to be real careful about drinking that water, bringing it into Tualatin Valley, and of course it'd be purified, but killing the bacteria doesn't necessarily clean up everything that could cause problems if there's toxics in there. So you'd want to look at that and really make sure you'd solve the problems in the water before you brought that in as your water source. First you'd have to recognize what it is, which DEQ is saying the water's fine, but got all those fish having problems, you tend to wonder if that's really as good a water as it ought to be.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the Tualatin itself has suffered from serious water quality problems over the years.
Oh yes, and it's had a bad reputation also, but it certainly has improved over the last 10 years, gotten much much better than it used to be. And it used to have high bacteria levels, and that's one of the real benefits of the Scoggins Dam, is we're able to keep the water level up during the summer and keep the water temperature down, which is really important. I know you've talked to some people about I've seen photographs of it back in the 50s when the Tualatin River wasn't there. I've seen pictures of the total flow of the Tualatin was, it was 12 inches wide. Was how wide the river was. It was basically a ditch down the middle, and it was going and going because somebody had an irrigation right, and so they're running water down so he could pump it out to irrigate. And it just dried up because everybody pumped it out. There wasn't much to begin with, and so they're pumping out for irrigation, and it was gone. There wasn't a Tualatin River in the summer in the late 50s. And it's certainly much, much better than that, than it used to be on there. And sewage treatment that's gone in. Old systems used to be very inefficient, and now USA is collecting all of that and processing it, and it's gotten better and better as that has happened. And their new plant that takes out so much nitrogen, there's nothing left in it, or I guess it's phosphates. So they've got, I wouldn't do it myself, but I think that probably the water that comes out of the water that comes out of the Rock Creek treatment plant is probably cleaner than a lot of water in some of the back eastern cities that's going through the drinking water systems. I don't know, it's probably not quite that extreme, but it's really cleaned water going out of there. And and we also have larger flows, as you know, because of the, it's one benefit of the people coming in, is we get a lot more water, and a lot of our water comes from the Bull Run system into the drinking water systems for Beaverton and Tigard. And then when people turn on their faucets or flush the toilet, that water goes through the treatment plants and ends up being dumped in the Tualatin. So we have higher volume in the river because of sewage.
Transfer from Bull Run to the Tualatin via people's toilets.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not the nicest transfer system to think about, but it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard figures that in the summertime, that USA's effluent accounts for perhaps as much as a third of the total flow down the Tualatin.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, USA has had its own troubled history with respect to the Tualatin.
Yeah.
They were born right about the time you came to this area. under the building moratorium that was slapped on Washington County by DEQ, I think it was, or at least by the state of Oregon. And that, I guess, forced the consolidation of a bunch of small sewage districts. Were you aware of
those? I wasn't really following that at all when it happened.
It probably was even starting to happen, or maybe happened even before you came here. Mm-hmm. And then USA, of course, got a bunch of federal money that was available under the Clean Water Act in the 70s to build many of these new facilities that they now
collection
operate.
Collection systems and treatment plants, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that was an opportunity then. I'm not so sure that federal largesse is available these days.
Don't believe so.
But then they found themselves in trouble again by the mid-80s. Even though they probably just barely finished constructing some of these plants and they're supposedly state-of-the-art technology, then they wound up hauled into court by a group down in Lake Oswego that was suing them because they were violating the terms of their discharge permit. And they also, I think, simultaneously sued the Environmental Protection Agency to enforce the Clean Water Act on the Tualatin. Were you aware of those events when they took place?
I wasn't involved in those or really party to anything to do with those at that time, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure I read some little news article about it, but wasn't involved in it at all.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that led to them then taking a look at the phosphorus especially. You mentioned that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've got it down down to at least close to the limit. Well, maybe they made the limit that the DEQ wanted them to make.
Well, this may come up as the flow management meeting yesterday, and I guess the phosphorus are okay. They got real high on their nitrates this month, and they don't know where it's coming from. There's some ammonia problem, and they can't tell where the ammonia is coming from, but something has come in. It seems to, if I'm remembering it right, it seemed to be coming in almost on a regular basis towards the end of the week on a Thursday or Friday. Something would come into their Rock Creek treatment plant, which would wipe out all the bacteria that are supposed to remove ammonia from the effluent. And so then they'd have high ammonia going out, which was greatly exceeding their limit. And they'd have to shut down everything and hold it in storage. And they were trying to bring in bacteria cultures from their other plants, from Durham plant and the Hillsboro plant, and just get bacteria cultures in and rush them in so they had bacteria to process the waste, because something was coming in and they can't find out what it is. And as I understand, they have a permit that says that they can exceed the nitrogen levels, required levels in the month. They can exceed it 15 days. Kind of a funny limit, but you can exceed it 15 days and you're okay, and if you exceed it 16 days, then you're out of compliance. And they have already exceeded it 15 days, so they're working their tails off to try and not exceed it one more day before Sunday. But understand the fine if they exceed it is something like $30,000. They have already brought in technical help and specialists and put in people overtime trying to fix it. They've spent a couple $100,000 this month trying to solve that problem. I mean, they just want to get it solved. They're not worried about the fine. That would be small. If they could pay the fine and have it fixed, they'd love to do that. But they put in several $100,000 this month just trying to figure out what is coming in here and what's going wrong with it, because they can't find out where it's coming from. And they've got tests out on their feeder line, so if they can figure out where, if it's coming from some factory or some place, what's coming in here to cause this, they just don't know. So they're doing some sweaty, intensive investigative work to try and figure out what's going on right now in their treatment plans.
Mm-hmm. So, guess they're in a position now where they maybe have to take some of their discharge standards more seriously as a result of increased vigilance on the part of everybody?
Well, they, at least my perspective is that they, you know, they want to keep them down low, because I think a lot of the people want good water quality, and certainly they want a good public image, and it isn't a good public image if you, you know, let's just get as push it as far close to the end as we can. You know, we want to keep it clean, and they want to look like they're trying to keep it clean for public image. And they don't want to hurt the fish or make the algae grow or anything like that. At least I know a lot of the people there, at least a lot of the individuals, certainly they want to do it because it's the right thing to do. You know, maybe there's somebody who has some other motives on there, but I think that at least most people that I know of are just concerned to get it done because it, you know, they want to keep the water clean and keep people healthy and make the fish grow better in the river and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At least that's experience for the people I've worked with over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that USA started off with this, you know, a black eye as a result of that lawsuit, probably, and mm-hmm. And has responded.
And that lawsuit actually did the river, I think, quite a bit of good because of the, I don't know, what was it, $1 million or something they put in the endowment fund, which supports water quality projects every year through the grant process, which has been really helpful. I mean, we've gotten some of those here in the district, and a lot of other groups have gotten grants that have helped out water study and purification and water quality enhancement and education efforts a great deal. So been a side benefit from the damage caused by it originally has had a long-term benefit. So
right. Let me just pause here for a second.